The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UAP reality. Hi, I'm David Twitchell, and for the next hour, we'll be exploring the mysteries of the UFO, UAP, and abduction phenomenon.
Today, we actually have two guests. Mr. Chad Wainless and Professor David Pelichick. Chad Wainless is the author of Hidden in Plain Sight, Evidence of Exotic UFO Propulsion, and the soon-to-be-released book Missing Time 2, spelled T-O-O, An Ordinary Man's Extraordinary Journey. Chad's education includes studies at Emily Carr University of Art and Design and the British Columbia Institute of Technology, with a focus on mechanical drafting, computer-aided design, and 3D modeling. He uses the expertise professionally as a mechanical designer and industrial consultant. David Pelichick is the co-author of the Hidden in Plain Sight book and brings over four decades of experience as a senior electrical and electronic engineering technologist. His career spans from IBM Canada to academia and advanced electronic security systems design, with specialization in infrared imaging technology. A veteran member of MUFON Canada, he has held leadership roles in national investigations and now guides CSSAA's global research initiative. So, it's a mouthful, but welcome to the show, Chad and Dave.
Thank you.
Thanks, David.
So, let's start here. Chad, tell us, in layman's terms, because that's all I can understand, what your theory is on UFO propulsion.
Okay. Well, what I've broken it down into is it leads off from Luis Elizondo's book, Imminent. In that book and in the videos with To the Stars, they were talking about the five observables, that being it's anti-gravity lift, hypersonic velocity, sudden acceleration, low observables, and transmedium travel. Now, those five are theorized by Louise and Hal Puthoff as being a signature of the Alcubierre warp drive. There are a large number of different theories as to how UAP traversed the sky. There's, probably five or six different theories, and they're adamantly defended by different people. And what I found was five additional observables. And these are gravitational lensing, leading edge vapor cones, oscillation blur, gravity counterbalancing, low velocity disk flight, which is a tilted flight to counteract Earth's gravity, and saucer-like skipping motion for high-speed horizontal travel. Now, basically, it started out with Dave and I. I'd watched a podcast, The Angry Astronaut, about a year ago, and he had shown a video on, there's a Saturn-shaped UAP that was filmed from an aircraft, from a commercial airliner, by a passenger as it traversed the sky. And Jordan, the podcaster, had slowed it down. And when I looked at it, my eye caught background changes to the clouds. So as this UAP was traveling in front of the background clouds, the clouds were shifting left and right with every frame. And both Dave and I have a software program that allows us to do video editing. So I actually looked at it on a frame by frame basis. And sure enough, with every frame, those background clouds moved. So I called up Dave and said, "You got it down. Let's take a look at it. What do you think? Is this gravitational lensing?"
And Dave, I looked at that with Chad, and it's what I call the aha moment, because sure enough, you could see some very interesting parameters of flight that nobody had ever looked at before. That's why we called it hidden in plain sight. So I went back to Chad and said, "Yeah, this is amazing. So let's continue. Go for it." And Chad started diving into it, and boy, did he dive deep into it.
Well, tell us a little bit more about gravitational lensing.
Okay. Well, basically, it is an astronomical term. It was first defined by Albert Einstein, and it was in his 1915 publication. And then it was confirmed in 1919 using photographs of a solar eclipse. An astronomer wanted to test his theory, went to Southern Hemisphere. Two different groups went to Southern Hemisphere and took photos of the eclipse. And so what Einstein predicted was that the gravity, the warping of space, which causes gravity, is going to cause light to bend around the sun and come back towards the Earth. So these stars, in theory, were supposed to appear farther away from the sun than they should have. Now, normally you can't see the background stars, but in an eclipse you can, where the moon blocks out the sun, so then you can see the background stars. So the photographs show that indeed it was correct. The stars were visibly farther away from the sun than they should have been, if it was a direct line of sight. So that confirmed Einstein's theory, and it confirmed gravitational lensing at the same time.
Einstein's theory is more commonly known as Einstein rings, for your listeners. If they've heard, I'm sure they've heard that term, Einstein rings.
Yeah. So an Einstein ring is where you have a galaxy between us and another galaxy. So the mass of the intermediate galaxy bends the light from the farther galaxy. So if they're perfectly in alignment with each other, the light from the farther galaxy will bend all the way around from all angles, come around that intermediate galaxy and bend back towards the Earth, creating a perfect ring, and sometimes an arc, but a perfect ring around that intermediate galaxy. And that's why they called Einstein rings, is because there's this glowing ring surrounding this galaxy. And then the arcs are called Einstein arcs, where it's a partial ring instead of a full ring. And it all depends on just how we're aligned. And so I realized that if Hal Puthoff and Luis Elizondo were correct, if the Alcubierre warp drive was being used, then Alcubierre predicted that through negative energy, you can warp space itself, and that spatial warp causes gravity. So the best way to describe this for people, so you have an understanding of what exactly gravity is imagine this. Take a block of wood, drill two holes through it. Now thread some string through those holes and tie those two pieces of string to a doorknob. And then the block of wood's between you and the doorknob, and you take the other two ends of the string and you pull them apart with both hands, pull them apart, away from your center of your mass, center of your body. That block of wood will then slide away from you and towards the doorknob. In this metaphor, the doorknob represents the Earth, or some massive body in space. You are represented by the block of wood, and the string represents the spatial warp. And so the Earth bends space just like those strings. And then because you're inside that bent warp space, it's like a lever effect that's applied simultaneously to every molecule in your body, and you are forced away from the spread going, being outer space, and down towards Earth, where the space comes closer together. And so you're forced down like a lever to the ground. And so that's how gravity works. Now, in the case of the Alcubierre warp drive, you're doing the same thing. You're bending space behind a craft, and you're compressing space in front of the craft. And so you're creating that same lever string pulling effect. And anybody or any craft that's inside that bent space is going to feel like an acceleration, gravitational acceleration, towards the compressed space and away from the expanded space.
So, Dave, is warp drive the same as Einstein's Rosen bridge?
No.
No, it's not.
But we are basing our theories on how these crafts are moving based on a known theory by Miguel Alcubierre, and all the math works to what we see in the UAP videos and how they move, and which we'll explain a little further. When you say, you know, warp drive, is it the same as other things? Warp's never been really proven, although there is a gentleman that has, and Chad's going to prove talk about that. So I don't know how you can compare it to anything else right now. It's still in its infancy of theoretics, although, like I said, it's been proven on a micro level. Actually, yeah. Probably even smaller than micro.
Has
the Rosen bridge been proven? I mean, you're folding space-time like a piece of paper?
Yeah, but they're totally separate. Warp drive is a propulsion system to go from point A to point B. The Rosenberg is, yes, warping time and space, and you know, and yeah, you bring them together, and A and B are right next to each other, and you just basically hop. So that's not the same as warp drive, although you might need warp drive to do that. No, we don't know, right? And has warping space and time, you have to do both, been proven? Theoretically, yes. But, you know, a warp drive has been physically proven. There's the big difference.
Okay.
Yeah, so think of it as the Rosen bridge is folding space versus creating a wave on the ocean that you're going to surf on. So that's an analogy of with the Alcubierre. It's like you're creating a wave that a surfer surfs on versus...
Yeah, I hate to say it, I'm going to interject here. I hate to say it, but we're so used to sci-fi shows like Star Trek and Star Wars, and you see warp drive and, you know, warp 1, warp 10, warp 10 being infinite speed. Mm-hmm. That's more close to the Rosen bridge because you are going from point A to point B in zero time. But the warp drive is basically, you know, let's use Star Trek, you know, warp 1, warp 2. It's so many times the speed of light. And it's not linear. It's not warp 2 is twice the speed of light. It's twice the speed of the first one. So warp 3 is basically four times the speed of light. Like that part has been proven a bit. So, you know, Hollywood didn't get it right, but they got it close.
Yeah.
So,
And in Star Trek, the Rosen bridge was, they called it a transconduit.
Transconduit. Yeah. That was more like Rosenberg's, you know, folding. Yep. Trans warp conduit.
Yeah.
They used the word warp, trans warp conduit. They actually used warp name in that because, again, that's also another theoretical solution to moving from point A to point B in space.
The reason I asked this question, I'm not going to go into it now because my listeners have heard this too much before, but I witnessed a craft coming through a hole in the sky, and the only explanation that, and I came right down over to treetop level. So the only explanation for that is warping, you know, coming through that Rosen bridge.
Or a wormhole or a portal. And We don't know what's on the other side. Was it the Rosenberg Bridge? Or did they actually use warp or trans warp conduits to get here? There's so many theories.
Yeah, the other theory that I like is that it wasn't it wasn't moving from place to place, but from time to time.
Yeah,
that could have been several hundred years in the future, or several days in the future, or several days in the past, and it could have moved through time. So when you saw it, like I've heard this description where this rectangle opens up in the sky at night, and you see blue sky on the other side.
Yes.
So it could be another time that is coming through.
Another time, another dimension, another world, parallel universes. There's four theories that are well accepted as where are these UAPs or non-human intelligence coming from. Mm-hmm. So we already know that. We know there's four. And again, it's parallel universes, parallel dimensions or other dimensions, actual space and time, travel using warp and forward or backwards in time. So it's four good possibilities. But moving back to the warp drive, let's talk about the good old doctor who proved the theory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How we can make use of the cells. Dr. White. Yep.
Yeah, it was a 2021 paper he released. And what he was doing is he was doing research on the Casimir effect, basically zero-point energy, trying to find out if it was real. And he was creating these super small 3D prints of about 4 micrometers across. That's smaller than a human hair. And so what he discovered by sheer accident was a configuration that created a micro-warp bubble that matched the Alcubierre theories. And so he was able to prove that, and in his paper it says this is not a simulant, this is a real warp bubble, but it's incredibly small. At the end of the paper he proposes, what if we create daisy chains and line a whole bunch of them up in a row, and he showed a diagram of 5 in a row. Well, would that look like, and would that create a larger warp bubble? And so the challenge is, like, warp bubbles are real. The challenge is how do you make them bigger? Something that's big enough to enclose a craft versus something that can enclose a piece of dust.
Yeah, well,
I'm sorry, Dave, go ahead.
Yeah, Bob Lazar's on Pentium is the power source, because you really do need a zero-point module. You need so much power, it's unbelievable. Which he was trying to create, Dr. White was trying to create, actually.
When you mention Bob Lazar, are we talking about Element 115?
Yep.
Okay.
On Pentium.
Yeah.
But we're going to talk about Bob Lazar in a little while, a little more. Yeah.
That'd be great. But
yeah. Okay.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No worries. So, yeah, going back to gravitational lensing, we identified several videos that showed it. Kenneth Knuth was actually the first researcher to spot gravitational lensing in a video, and he spotted it in the Aguadilla UAP video from 2013.
Mm-hmm.
And we independently discovered it, and another research group independently discovered it. So three groups have independently identified lensing occurring in this government video. And then we went on to researching other known photos and videos, and I even found one online. It was a TikTok video. The user is MD Ridoy Ahmed is his name, and it was again filmed from an aircraft, a passenger aircraft. And what I liked about this video was it starts out with a finger from the passenger next to him, pointing out the window. So the camera then gets pushed up to the window, and the camera's jostled around, but you see this disc, a very large disc, approaching the aircraft, and it changes directions up and down, left and right slightly, and then it zips off an incredible speed, like something like 3,000 miles per hour. It zips off horizontally, and it's gone in two frames, like two still frames of a video. So for the users, the listeners, a video is broken down to 30 still frames. There's 30 individual photographs that make up 1 second of a video. And so the last three frames that this thing is in, it's approaches, then it's halfway up the screen, and then it's almost off the screen, and then it's gone.
Mm.
And so you can do some math. If you assume the craft is about 200 feet in diameter, that's about 3,000 miles per hour departure speed. And
And
what?
that's nothing compared to some of them. But
Yeah, exactly.
I need to take a break right now to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, Making Waves, and you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, your host, and we're speaking with Mr. Chad Wainless and Professor David Pelichick. Okay, am I pronouncing that right, Dave?
You're close to mine and but far off on Chad's, to tell you the truth. Mine's Palachik, so you're very
Belichick.
close.
Belichick.
But Chad, and I'm going to say it is Wanless.
Wanless.
Yep. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
I'm put
That's okay.
WANLESS. And I say
Yep.
Wainless, and you say Wanless.
Wanless. Yeah, a lot of people think of it as, I hear Wanless, Wainless, it's Wanless.
It's Wanless.
And most people get it wrong. So don't feel bad.
Okay. So you just let it go. You didn't correct me. But now.
Exactly. And it's like Alcubierre. A lot of people get it wrong. It's really hard. You have to slow it down. It's L Q, then B, as I think of the word B as in a bumblebee, and then air as in the air we breathe. And then when I think of it that way, then I can pronounce it correctly.
I have to think of all that.
Yeah, I've been saying it wrong for years.
You know, I once had a gal, not to get off page here, but I once had a young lady say to me, "Well, what's your? How do you spell your last name, Twitchell?" And I said, "Twichell." She says, "That's not how you spell Twitchell."
She wanted an extra T in there, didn't she?
She wanted to, and a lot of people do put the extra T in there, and I have to correct them if it's important that I correct them. But
Not
she
spelled
just
like
told me
switch.
that's, that's not the way you spell your name. What's the matter with you? Anyway,
Worries.
do either or both of you guys feel that these craft, you mentioned the craft taking off at tremendous speed.
Yep.
Breakneck speed that would just actually crush the craft and kill the occupants. But do either of you believe that, you feel that the craft are enveloped in an electromagnetic field or inertia equalizer?
No, neither of that is required with the Alcubierre warp drive. You're enveloping the craft in a warp bubble.
Oh.
And it's shaped like a wine decanter. So you get a large base that bubbles out, then you've got a neck that comes back in and then expands out again. And so the craft, a vehicle can exist inside that lower half of the neck, just above the large expansion bubble underneath it. And so it's that lever effect I was describing. So the craft and its occupants all feel the gravitational acceleration at the same time. So to go really, really fast, you instead of having a small bubble, a small angle on the bubble, you have a large angle on the bubble, and it creates a larger lever effect, and the occupants and the craft accelerate at the same time, away from the bubble and towards the compression. And so therefore, if you didn't have windows, you wouldn't know the craft is moving. You wouldn't feel a thing. It's got its own built-in inertia dampening, essentially, is what you could say. But there's no additional devices that are needed. Like Star Trek, they didn't realize this. So they said, oh, we've got to have some way to keep people from getting crushed. So we'll put inertia dampers in. Well, the warp bubble creates a gravitational acceleration. So everyone falls away at the same time.
Even when
And
it
so,
stops.
even when it
Unlike,
stops.
yeah, unlike a car, David, when you're traveling at speed, I don't care if you're traveling at 50, 60 miles an hour or kilometers an hour, you're not really feeling the movement because you're moving with the car. The only thing you feel, unlike a UAP, is the start and the stops. So if you stop real hard, yeah, you feel the G forces, you get thrown forward. But what Chad's explaining is the entire thing stops. Or starts, or moves, or turns, or makes incredible movements. You're not feeling that inside.
So, is it the case that even though the craft is within Earth's gravitational field, it's not subject to its laws.
Well, it's overcoming Earth's gravitational field by creating its own gravitational field.
That's what I mean, yeah.
Yeah. So it's there's a downward pointing spatial warp caused by Earth that's being counteracted by an upward pointing spatial curve underneath the vehicle. And so that counteracts Earth's gravity. And then that leads into the fourth new observable, which is tilted flight. The reason why a lot of UAP, when you look at old photographs, are tilted is because they have to counteract Earth's gravity, but they have to go forward slightly. So at a slow speed, you're going to tilt your craft slightly to get some forward gravitational acceleration, but also an acceleration that counteracts Earth's gravity. And so it's the same as a helicopter. You tilt the helicopter blades forward and you start moving forward because you still have to counteract Earth's gravity, but you're getting a little bit of forward momentum. That's why helicopters have a slow forward velocity, is because they can only tilt their blades so far. And that's how UAP work at slower speeds. They point their gravity warp bubble up and slightly forward, and then they move slightly forward without falling back down towards the Earth.
And unlike then, a helicopter, though, helicopter yeah. only has one set of blades and one motor. What we've theorized, and Chad put together these fantastic pictures and diagrams in our book, is that there's multiple warp drives or nacelles. And nacelle is the actual term. It's not something from Star Trek. It's an actual term for this type of propulsion engine. So basically, you're increasing one side and decreasing the other. So you can't just have one. You have multiple. You might have a big one in the middle for the majority of the lift, but directional ones all around the craft, which is what says the perfect size shape is a circle. You know, you can have triangles that do the same thing, but the perfect shape is more of a circle. And it's also something to do with keeping the bubble around the craft and, you know, using storage facility on the outsides. And I don't think I'd want to be the very outside of a craft anyways. You know, I might still get splattered against the wall. You never know. But anyways, yeah. So by having multiple nacelles, you can control a craft, which is why Chad is explaining it pitches to one side. Like a helicopter, yep. You increase one and decrease the other, and yeah, you've changed the bubble around and the effects.
Yeah. To further that, basically the way the configuration works is you have one central warp nacelle, dead center of the craft. It's a vertical tube that comes from basically the main floor all the way up to the top of the roof and may protrude through the roof, and then you have three or more smaller warp nacelles in a triangular position below the main deck, but outside of they're farther away from center of the disc. So you turn all four on. The lower ones you turn on slightly. And then if you want to adjust your tilt, you would turn, say, the left one down slightly and turn the right one up slightly. And then your craft will tilt to the left, and then you turn them all back on the same amount. And now you've got that tilt that I was describing that allows you to move forward and counteract Earth's gravity. And so that configuration mathematically works within the Alcubierre warp matrix. And it happens to be exactly what Bob Lazar described with the sport model. He described a central, he didn't use the right terms because the hit, his description of the warp system was before Alcubierre's paper was published 6 years later, but he called it a gravitational emitters and a warp guide or a gravity guide in the center. And they're all gravitational emitters. They all work together as one to create a cone shaped nesting that encompasses the entire craft with this warp bubble.
But regardless, it equalizes the inertia in it, right?
Yep, correct.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Yep. So inertia equalizer works in this case, right?
Yeah.
It's part of it. It's part of it. So Chad just mentioned something very interesting, that he said the nacelle in the middle of the craft could stick up above. So let's go back to the 50s, Chad, to look at some photos long before computers, long before CGI. And we're talking about the Trent and the Rouen photos in 1952 and 1956, I believe. You can correct me if I'm wrong. Yeah. Talk about those, Chad, because they clearly show exactly what Chad is describing. Long before we even saw these photos, we had theorized this, and then we found these photos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Paul Trent McMinnville photos, 1950, and the Rouen, France photos in 1954. Both photos show a similar disc, same make and model, and they have a cone that sticks out of the center of the top of the craft. And then in the book, I'd overlaid a grid and a spatial warp on top of it. And what it showed was I'd done an expansion on the lower left in both photos with doing a what's called a scatter plot. Basically, it shows how space is warped around it with a series of dots created, the lines created of dots. And so in both cases, there's a higher compression above left of this disc. And so on the left side of the disc, both discs, it's a little bit compressed. On the right side, it's a little bit expanded. But more importantly, that central cone isn't on the center. It's actually slightly left of center and leaning slightly towards the left side. And then when you look at the scatter plot overlay, it lines up perfectly with that configuration, and it shows exactly how the crafts, those two objects, are being warped visually by gravitational lensing. As the light is bouncing off their surfaces, that light is being redirected slightly, and the camera that captured it, it looks like these cones are out of place, like they're slightly centered, off-centered, slightly tilted. But it's an optical illusion caused by the gravitational lensing of the warp drive itself.
Okay, so skeptics always complain that the UFO photos come out looking blurry.
Blurry, yes.
We have an answer for that. You know, Chad, you want me my nice little explanation?
Yeah, go for it.
Please.
Well, if you look at our book, you'll see the scatter plot shows that you have a bigger warp bubble on the bottom than the top in order for it to move. We're always looking up, and we're looking through that warp bubble. So, of course, you're not going to see it clearly. There is the one that Chad was talking on TikTok, where they're above a craft looking down, and it's fairly clear. It's slightly off a little bit, but the warp bubble is smaller on the top. And everybody keeps saying, if it's clear, it's CGI. But we proved that that was not. So, basically, they're not turning on the fuzzy photo device in the cartoon show all the time. You're looking through a warp bubble. You're never going to see it clear. And Chad, you can explain how they don't see clear until they do something.
Yeah, exactly. So there's another one that we called warp oscillation, one of the other new observables. And the reason being is, if we're seeing the object slightly warped, imagine you're the pilot and you're inside the craft and the light is coming into you and you're seeing it slightly warped as well. And so the world is squished to your view and it becomes a flight hazard. How are you going to land or fly close to the ground properly if you don't know exactly where the ground is? And the way I describe it is, imagine you're driving along and you're wearing someone else's prescription glasses and you can't see quite right. So you think you're going too far left or too far right. So you change the steering wheel, turn it slightly, and then all of a sudden the prescription on the glasses changed. So every time you change the steering wheel position, the prescription changes. And so you're always trying to correct it. And this is what causes the saucer effect, or the skipping across water effect, is you're constantly trying to adjust for this warped field that you're looking through. And you're, am I flying level? No, I'm not. I'm going too high. Okay, I'll adjust it. Oh, no, I'm going too low. Oh, no, I'll adjust it. Now I'm going too high. No, I'll adjust it. And you do this up and down motion because of that. But there's another set of photos from Rex Heflin. It happened in, I believe, 1968. And it's four photographs. And it's really interesting. The first two photographs, you see the disc tilted in two different positions, but it's blurry. Yet the background, the telephone poles, are crystal clear. And then the third photo is really, really interesting. It's a double exposure. You see the craft in two different positions, slightly overlapping. Everything else is perfectly clear. But what had happened was halfway through the opening aperture, the craft had adjusted its warp bubble. And so it was on and then it was off. And so in the on position, you see it slightly left and it looks perfectly symmetrical. And then when that was when the warp bubble was off, but when the warp bubble was turned on, it smeared and slightly to the right and warped. And so you can see both positions, and I highlighted them in green and red in the book. And then, so what was going on was this craft was oscillating and it was using a camera system is what we, this, as an engineer, this is what I would do in this system, in this type of warp drive system. If I wanted my pilots to see clearly, I would oscillate the warp drive on and off about 15 times, 30 times a second. When the warp drive is off, I'd turn the camera on. So I'd capture 1/15th of a second of normal light coming through. Then I'd turn the camera off, turn the warp drive back on, and continue to display that 1/15th of a second. And then I would turn the warp drive off and I'd turn the camera back on. And so the pilot would be able to see the world unaffected by the warp drive. And so you could see it clearly without any gravitational lensing. The problem is to someone on the ground, that craft will look like it's blurred because it's switching
oscillating.
Oscillating its warp drive on and off, and the gravitational lensing of the actual craft itself will appear, as Rex said, Rex Heflin said, even to his own eyes, the object appeared blurry. It's because it was oscillating. And then the fourth photo shows something really interesting and unique. There's a big smoke ring as after it departed, and there's a small line in the top left of the photograph that might be the UAP off at a distance. And everyone was always like, what is this smoke ring? And it goes back to something that we discovered in the Aguadilla.
Yeah, before you get into that, let's. Yep. I'm sure David's got some questions. First of all, these 1962 pictures, again, were before CGI and computers.
Yep.
And not only that, it was shot with a Polaroid camera. You can't change it. You can't edit it. You can't go into the dark room unless you take another picture. But they were given as the original Polaroid cameras. And so there's proof there. And secondly, I work in electronic security systems. And what Chad came up with when he asked me about it, and I gave him the information he needed, this is quite possible. You know, focusing a camera and having it shoot, you don't shoot like constant. You're shooting at so many frames per second. So if you match the opposite of the pulse on the warp drive, you get a clear picture, no picture, clear picture, no clear picture. But the thing is, to our eye, we only need 15 frames a second to see perfect motion. So you could be oscillating this at 1,000 frames per second. You're going to see clear motion anywhere from 12 to 15 frames per second. And I do this all the time for my customers and when I'm designing security systems. So this theory holds 100%, you know, water, 100% true.
I need to take one more break to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, and you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm your host, David Twitchell, and we're speaking with Chad Wanless and Professor David Palachik. Did I get that right, Chad?
Yep.
Okay. Don't ask me to say it again. No, I'm kidding.
Oh, come on. So now Chad's got some interesting stuff he's going to go into with this, what people call a smoke ring. But remember, it was black and white.
Okay.
So it might not have been black.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah. So what we found in the, I first noticed it in the Aguadilla UAP. Now, that was a, not a black and white photo, but it was a IR camera.
Yep.
And so I noticed there was this really white cloud forming over top of that UAP as it was traveling across darker backgrounds. You usually didn't see it until it passed in front of something hotter. And so that you see this little cloud that formed over, usually leading on the leading edge where it's, like I was describing, tilted slightly forward, but sometimes that cloud stretched out across the entire top of the UAP. And so what I theorized was that spatial compression that happens above the UAP, as it travels through the air, think of the spatial compression. We'll use another television show, Doctor Who and his TARDIS. So you've got this police box. It's about 192 square feet in size. But inside, you step in, and it's at least 10,000, not square feet, sorry, cubic feet, 10,000 cubic feet or more of space inside something that's 192 cubic feet in size. And so this is what spatial compression is. Someone outside will see this small area, what looks like small, but it's actually an incredibly large volume of space. And so as the UAP travels through the air, in this case, the Aguadilla, the UAP traveled about 100 to 120 miles an hour, air is going to find itself suddenly, let's say 1 cubic foot of air finds itself inside of 10 cubic feet of space suddenly. Well, that creates what we call adiabatic cooling. It's a term that's used in HVAC engineering, which I used to do, where you compress air and then as it expands, it rapidly cools down. And that's how we get our air conditioning. But that rapid cooling causes moisture in the air to form vapor droplets and form a cloud. Mm-hmm. And so what we're seeing on top of this UAP as it's traveling is this HVAC condition where it's cooling the air and that air is condensing into a cloud. And the IR camera is seeing the cold cloud against the hot UAP just below it, or the cloud, cold cloud just above the hot UAP. And I looked in other videos and I've also seen in photos, and going back to Rex Heflin, that smoke ring is another vapor cloud. What happened there was as it rapidly departed, it created a condensed space, pocket of space in front of it, which condensed all that moisture in the air into a cloud. But then it went straight through the cloud and created a smoke ring. So the ring is actually the result of the craft going directly through that cloud. And then
that's like the Chicago O'Hare.
Exactly. It's exactly like the Chicago O'Hare. The Chicago O'Hare went through the clouds vertically and it left an open hole in the hole in the cloud. Yeah. And then in the case of the MD Ridoy video that I've identified on TikTok, those last two still frames, as it disappears, there is a cloud that formed in front of the UAP as it departed. And that cloud exactly matches one-to-one correlation, the scatter plot of the spatial compression in front of a UAP and in the Alcubierre warp system, the warp matrix. And then the other thing I had to do was, it's hard to describe it in radio, but I had to add an elastic formula to this because the Alcubierre, the upper and the lower hemispheres didn't connect and I had to connect them. So I took me three tries, but I found a formula that worked that allows the lower hemisphere to bend back in and connect with the upper hemisphere. And that spatial compression, and I did a color map, and the highest condensation compression was just in front of the UAP, and it was this oval shape. And the Ridoy disk has an oval shape cloud right in front of it. And so it was an example of a one-to-one that matches the predicted spatial compression. And there's also the spatial compression in one of the still frames that matches quite nicely as well in the Aguadilla UAP. And then there's another video that came out just a month or two ago from Perth, Australia. There's a green orb that's flashing on and off and leaving this trail of smoke that is there momentarily behind it. And that was that's also what we think is the leading edge vapor cone being split by the UAP as it's traveling through this cloud it's creating in front of it.
I see.
Yeah.
And so do you think that we humans have back engineered warp drive from crashed disk, or Are we anywhere close to duplicating it?
Not a chance.
Not a chance, he says.
We don't even have the power. We need the power first.
My personal theory is we've probably taken the warp drive out of a broken craft, built our own man-made disk, and installed the warp drive in it so that we can have another functional device, another functional vehicle. It's half man-made, half recovered tech. But think of it this way. If you've recovered a crashed aircraft and the engine's perfectly good, but the wings are torn off, you could take that engine out and install it in a new aircraft and it'll still fly. It's just you've replaced the wings. And I think that's what we've done. I think we've got some crashed UAP, pulled the warp nacelles out, pulled the power source out, and installed them in a craft we built ourselves.
So, Chad, you sounds like you're saying you do believe they have back engineered this, or
no? It's different than back engineering. It is replacing a broken vehicle using someone else's engines.
The only problem with that is why I think we haven't done it is because we don't have the materials to make the end that craft that would go at extremely high speeds. The craft with our materials would disintegrate with the warp bubble. The warp bubble could even disintegrate it. Who knows? We don't know. But what Chad's saying, I do agree with. Have we taken parts out and used them? Yes, to an event. Did the UAP crash because it ran out of power? Something else happened? Did everything come down intact? And David, you were saying, have we back engineered it? And I think we're working on back engineering, but we don't have, again, the materials.
Right.
Yep.
So
I have a theory from way back in the mid 70s that we back engineered a craft and created fiber optics.
Oh,
that's
not
a mention of ours. No way. Yep. I did my thesis on that. They didn't like it. But anyways, the university had to accept it.
Yeah.
I think it's backward engineered.
So what I hear you guys saying is that, if we see there's supposed to be a theory that there's their, you know, ET's craft and our craft, we're flying around in our craft. Well, if we see a craft that is standing still, hovering, and then it zips off using warp speed, that can't be ours, correct?
No. Let me tell you something very quickly. A few years ago, I got a video from a person out in Alberta, Canada, who was flying a drone, and something went by the drone so fast he didn't even notice it. When he was reviewing later, he stopped his video just to take a picture of a still picture of the beautiful forest that he was flying over. And beside his craft was this streak. So then he played the thing in slow motion and he sent it to me. And it was, you know, size is irrelevant. It was probably maybe 2 feet across, smaller than the drone. And he was using a professional drone with 60 frame per second camera on it. And when I went through every single frame, and there wasn't too many, I found that it had traversed 600 meters in 1.7 seconds. Mm. That was passing the craft and still accelerating at Mach 12. Mm. A couple of weeks later, another one was spotted down in the U.S., exact same shape, exact same scenario, and it was doing Mach 17. So now I contacted a person on MUFON who was an ex-NASA engineer to get my numbers verified, and all the numbers were verified at Mach 12, and he did the one in the States at Mach 17. And then I asked him, is this a NASA or U.S. military device? And he sent me back one little communication that says, not ours.
Right.
That was it. No more comment, and never since has he given any more comments.
Yeah.
So that proves what I'm saying is true. It can't be ours. It moves like that.
Yeah, and by the way, it was only a couple feet across relative to the drone, like 2 feet, and the drone was maybe 3 feet. But size is a relative. There could be somebody in there as tall as you and I, only in a micro scale, like an ant. Like, you can't. Everybody says, well, how does somebody fit in there? Like, we don't all have to be 5 foot 10, you know?
Very often we get reports from, I don't have to tell you guys, you're investigators, people that I saw the craft and it was about the size of a minivan, and all of a sudden I was inside and it was huge.
The yep. TARDIS.
What is it, Alice in Wonderland type thing or what? You know?
It's the TARDIS effect.
Right.
You can, if theory would be, if you could use a spatial compression, like the upper half of the Alcubierre spatial compression, and point that inwards all the way around, then what will happen is the interior of the craft, in the interior of the TARDIS, would be 10,000 cubic feet, in surrounded by a shell that's only 200 cubic feet. Mm-hmm. So, in theory, it's possible.
Makes you wonder of the author of Doctor Who and what he knows about what, right?
Yeah.
Good imagination, and not only am I a Star Trek fan, but I'm a great Doctor Who fan. I have a little mini Doctor Who TARDIS on my table. You can't see it, but it's my fridge. It actually cools bottles of water.
But so when you open your fridge door, it's huge, right?
I've been trying to get it to do that. It's just not working. I can still only get a dozen bottles in it.
You'd be able to store a lot more beer in there.
Yep.
Well, I didn't want to say there's a beer fridge, but you caught me.
I got it. Anyway, Chad, tell us briefly, we're kind of short on time, but yep. Tell us briefly about your upcoming book, Missing Time 2, T.O.
Okay. So that's where I was going to go next when you said, who's it's not ours. Well, who is ours? Like, through this book, the first book, I said, there's no way to tell who are the occupants. There's no scientific instrument in the world that could peer inside these craft and go, they are such and such people, or they are such and such beings, or they're Chinese, Russian, whatever, right? If you want to know who the pilots are, you got to talk to the people like myself who claim to have been inside. Now, in my case, I had a large number of missing time events growing up. The first one happened, missing time that I caught was age 8, but I had other events that happened even earlier in childhood where I saw UFOs. First and second, age 3 and 6, I saw UFOs. Age 8 was a missing time event. 12 was a missing time event with a huge cut on the front of my ankle that didn't hurt. It was perfect scalpel cut, 1.5 wide, 1.5 deep. Mm. Then I had a missing time event at age 16, another one at 18, which actually I saw a UFO as well, but I talked to my friends. We didn't know what it meant. No, there was no missing time in high school literature. There was the book Missing Time had just come out like a year or two earlier mm-hmm. from Bob Hopkins. And so I was completely clueless. All I could say is I thought there was some weird aspect of phenomena in nature that causes time to skip and jump every once in a while. I didn't know what it meant. Mm-hmm. And then
How old were you at that time?
I was 20 years old when I finally figured out.
When you thought this was all natural.
Yeah. I was in my late teens. I was remembering back on these different periods of missing time after at age 18. I was delivering my sister's newspapers because she was sick. I was 2-3 blocks from home, 15-minute walk tops. I delivered the last newspaper. I looked at my watch. It said it was 5:30. I looked up in the sky. Something caught my eye. And there was this disc hanging down at a 45-degree angle through the clouds. And it zipped up really quickly into clouds. And I thought, that can't be an airplane. They don't hover and then zip really quickly. And then, so I continued on home. I got home, what I thought was 5 minutes later. It was pitch black. I open up the door, I get in, and Mom's like, where have you been? You should have been home hours ago. This is something I've heard many times from my mother growing up. And I'm like, well, I was delivering my sister's newspaper. She's no, you should have been home hours ago. It's 8:30. I'm like, what do you mean it's 8:30? It should be 5:45. And I look up at the clock, and sure enough, it's 8:30. And so that was when I was like, you know, I remember, you know, that driving home at 16, it took me 3 hours to drive home, a 20-minute drive. I remember age 12, a walk home from school that should have been 20 minutes. I was 3 hours late. I remembered, you know, when I was 8 years old, waking up in the middle of the night, it was bright as day. My best friend was sleeping over. So we went upstairs to watch the television, turned on the TV. There was an off-air signal. It said it was 2:30 in the morning. We're like, that's weird. Didn't think much of it. He's the son of a dentist. Says, let's go brush our teeth. Okay, we go to the bathroom. It's pitch black, that window. We come out, everything's black. This is really weird. How was it daylight at 2:30 in the morning? I go to turn the television off. Now the off-air signal says it's 5:30 in the morning. 3 hours gone like that. And I was thinking at age 18, how does time skip and jump? There must be some weird phenomena in nature. And then at age 20, I discovered the book Missing Time by Bud Hopkins. And I start reading through it and I'm like, oh my God, this happened to me. I remembered the, he described an event with an abductee where he was out at night in the middle of the morning, but it was bright as day. And I'm like, oh my God, I remembered age 8, bright as day. And then I was like, it had to be my friend. It couldn't have been me. I was in denial. It had to be my friend. It couldn't have been me. And I jumped back and forth. And then I read the next chapter. And a lady talked about walking over in her family's farm. She was in the barn. Then suddenly she was outside and she had a perfect scalpel cut on her leg, inch wide, inch deep. And I'm like, oh my God, that's just like grade 12 when I was missing 3 hours. I walked home and all of a sudden there's this perfect scalpel cut on my ankle that's half inch wide, half inch deep. I could see it cut through the muscle perfectly. I could see the cartilage at the bottom of the ankle. And I was like, it was me, not my friend. And I was devastated. And it took me years to come to grips with it.
Well, this sounds like very complicated and something that I'd like to get into with you. But unfortunately, we are out of time. But maybe we can get together another time and you can discuss this.
Let's do that. Let's schedule a part two.
A part two. That'd be very exciting. But right now, where can our listeners go to find out about your present book?
The book, Hidden in Plain Sight, is on Amazon. And you can also find it on my website, true-experiences.ca. And Missing Time 2 will be out either late July or early August. And it will also be on Amazon and on the same website.
Very good. What about you, Dave? You got any plans for another book?
I'm working on another one I'm going to ask Chad to help on. And one of the ones we want to do is more about propulsion and why Roswell happened, you know, the crash. We have a theory of why it happened. We kind of hinted to it. There's a lot more things coming up with some of the knowledge that I have, being the National Director Emeritus of MUFON Canada. There's a lot more coming in. But right now, I am the President and CEO of, as you said, CSSAA, but we call it CESA, which actually stands for the Center for the Scientific Studies of Atmospheric Anomalies. This group has been traveling the world for 17 years approximately now. They've been to over 20 countries, 60, 80 some odd cities, talking to people who are making contact and doing sky watches. And I have seen so many UAPs and other phenomenon. Mm-hmm. You know, I understand it all. I've seen it all. And yeah, it's all true. And, you know, I've talked a lot of experiences too. And Chad's got an incredible story. I can't wait to read. I've read it. It'll be finalized and I can't wait for it to come out.
When your book comes up, let me know. We'll do another show. But Chad, yeah. You're going to mess me up, huh? Wanless. Chad Wanless and Professor David Pelichick. I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and we are not alone.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
And I want to thank you, the loyal listener. Go to WHFR's homepage, scroll down to We Are Not Alone, and click on the headline, which will take you to where you can find my website with all the archived shows. Or click on the Talk Shows button, then the We Are Not Alone button for the latest show archives. And please join me the first Monday of each month at 2 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UAP phenomenon. And until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.